Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 35 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the polymathic author Simon Ray speaks with Carol Angier about his writing life as a poet, biographer, playwright and young adult novelist.
Poet, playwright, biographer, broadcaster and novelist, Simon Ray has written the definitive biography of the greatest ever cricketer, W.G. Grace, A Life, 1998. Published several collections of poetry, most recently Gift Horses, 2006. And won the National Poetry Competition in 1999. For several years, he presented Radio 4's Poetry Please, and he has written and presented many other radio programs. He has also edited several anthologies, including The 20th Century in Poetry, co-edited with Michael Hulse, 2011. His plays have toured extensively in the UK, and his one-man, Macbeth, played by David Keller, opened the Gdansk Shakespeare Festival in 2011. His first novel for younger readers, Unplayable, 2009, was Nicholas Lazard's choice in the Guardian Review, and has been followed by Keras, 2013, from David Fickling Books, and Medusa's Butterfly, 2014, from Corgi. Simon, you've had an extraordinarily varied career. Many of us stick to one genre, or even sometimes one subject, but your keynote seems to be change. You've said, because you actually have a nice line in Self-Mockery, that the only consistency in your career is violent inconsistency. Actually, this isn't true. A few strong lines run all through your work, I think. A love of nature, especially English nature, the English countryside. A love of that other epitome of Englishness, cricket. A great love and deep knowledge of English poetry, which issued in your editing two poetry anthologies 32 years apart. Nonetheless, you have written in almost every genre under the sun, poetry, plays, biography, and now children's fiction. What I want to know is, how did you start writing?
There are probably two answers to that. I started writing stories at a fairly early age, and I enjoyed English at school very much, especially when English homework, or prep as we called it, consisted of writing a story. And indeed I had an affecting piece in the school magazine in which I was musing at the graveside of my mother, which amused her greatly because she was very far from dead and in fact has only recently died. So where that came from, I don't know. So I think there was always a sort of storytelling element to me. But I really started as a published writer, as a poet. And that was partly because in the throes of academic work and getting into university and all the rest of it, a poem is a much easier thing to start and finish than a novel, a play, or what have you. And I think, like most poets, I started by imitating other poets, and I thought, this doesn't look as difficult as I'd always thought it was. And so I sort of stumbled into it, and my first sort of adult published work would have been a poem, I would guess.
Well, that does agree with your CV, which shows that you started publishing with poetry. For instance, your poems in Faber's Introduction 5, published in 1982, and Great Two, your book of poems about that extraordinary Oxfordshire village, published in 1989. Many of the poems in Introduction 5 are about country scenes, and Great Two is about a country village, slowly decaying away. So would you agree that the English countryside was an early inspiration for your writing? Is that true? And if so, how did it start?
What happened was that I was teaching at Banbury School and I got tired of my digs and put an advertisement in the local newspaper. And I spent a lot of time wondering whether I would describe myself as a professional or as a teacher. I plumped for teacher in the end and I only got one response to that advertisement. which was from two other teachers who were living in the schoolhouse at Great Tew. And I could only live in that house with them because I was a teacher. That was what was stipulated in the lease. So I got onto my little moped and bobbled over to Great Tew. And as soon as I arrived in this sort of lost and forgotten world, I just knew I had to live there. And that was 1976. And of course, that was the summer of the epic heatwave and drought. And I really was on a separate planet. And I just stumbled around the Great Tew estate in all its gothic dereliction, taking in images and trying to write poems about it. It kick-started my life as a poet, without any doubt at all. At the same time, I was reading widely in John Clare and had the idea at that stage of writing a doctorate on him. I'm very, very glad that that didn't happen. But Clare was my way in. Well, Clare and Craig Raine, funnily enough, because Clare was a countryman and knew every last blade and the names of every species of butterfly and small creature. And I came from a town. I was brought up in Canterbury and knew nothing of this. So I was very much more like Craig Raine's visiting Martian. So there's a very odd fusion there, which I think you can see in my early poems about Great Tew. But I was just stumbling on a world of intense fascination for me. And I wrote and I wrote and I wrote. And I'm not generally a prolific poet, but I was for that sort of period. And for about another 18 months, I wrote a lot of poems.
Could you just tell us a little bit about Great Tew? Because I'm not sure how many people will know about it. It's not just that it is the most beautiful village and the most beautiful countryside, but it was, when you arrived there, a dying village, wasn't it? Perhaps that was part of it. Part of what inspired you was not just, you know, the beauty of it, but the fact that it was disappearing.
Well, Great Tew was an estate village. It was built all in the same wonderful dark red stone, thatched cottages. It was built part and parcel, sort of in a relatively small period of years. It was dominated by the big house, as all the estates were. But what made it unique was that the estate kept the ownership of all of the houses, and no new building was allowed. So it was completely unspoiled. Now, that was an attempt at preservation, but it was a doomed attempt at preservation because there simply wasn't the money to keep putting the roofs back on these increasingly derelict cottages. So when I arrived there, it was probably at its absolute nadir. I mean, it really was like something out of, you know, Goldsmith. It was just a completely ruined. And the old man who owned it lived as a recluse in about three rooms up in the big house. Was almost never seen. I think he came out for one royal occasion and handed out some prizes to the school children or something in the school. But it really was, it was like living, as I've said, in a parallel universe. And so obviously for an imaginative writer, I mean, it was a godsend. Subsequently, the estate was taken over by somebody else, and gradually its economic potential was realised. The first building that was sold was the pub, which was conveniently right opposite the schoolhouse where I was living. And then one by one, these ruined cottages were sold off, and very rich people, mainly from London, came in and put hundreds of thousands of pounds into them. And it is now a sort of unspoilt village for very, very rich villagers. But during that period of dereliction, it was an extraordinary place.
I wonder whether you could perhaps read a bit from my favourite of the Great Tew poems. It's called The Walled Garden. It's about the garden of two spinster ladies who have long gone. And I quote from it, "The doyens of a lost imperium, the afterimage of a privilege that died one July morning on the Somme." Now, the last line of verse 4 is, "Of all that ancient glory there remains..." Could you go on from there, Simon?
"This morgue museum of abandonment, where orchids bloomed in cherished opulence, the trays and trestles gather mildewed dust, the orangery is drained of succulence, a lawnmower breaks out in powdery rust, mice scamper through their draughty tenement. I wander over to the bothies which once housed the men, and through a grill of holes drilled in a door, see hanging from a nail old bridles stiff with age, dissolving bales of hay, an ancient saddle on a rail. It won't be worth my while to try the latch. And so I trespass through the afternoon, pressing my nose against the cobwebbed panes, while up above me, through a perfect sky, scream relays of our allies' fighter planes. My cigarette reminds me I must die, this way or that, and relatively soon.
Thank you. Now, can I ask you about form? Your poems, then and later, seem to me to vary between free verse and quite traditional meter and rhyme schemes. So can you say something about a technique and the balance between free verse and traditional forms?
This used to drive me absolutely spare. It caused me great unease in one period of my life. And then after a while I realised that, I mean, the poets I admired were in particular Philip Larkin and Auden, both of whom were masters of form. James Fenton is another poet who influenced me and whom I greatly admire. And James seemed happy to switch between the two. So after a while I just stopped worrying about it. Sometimes a poem presents itself as needing to be in a strict form. Sometimes it doesn't.
I noticed that both of your poetry anthologies begin with Hardy's The Darkling Thrush, and then later you wrote a book about Victorian Edwardian Dorset, which of course also features Hardy very largely. Also, I noticed that in the 1984, I think, edition of Oxford Poetry, you share the pages with W.H. Auden. So were either of those influences on you, would you say?
Well, Auden, as I've said, was a major influence. He was far too intelligent for me to understand a lot of his poems, but I loved the sound they made. And I think Auden is so important for a whole generation of poets because he showed that, you know, modernism had not completely expunged rhyme and metre from the landscape. At his best, I think he's so stimulating, a wonderful poet. And also what I like about Auden is that he was not grand. He would write little squibs and little ditties and things that amused him. And, you know, he didn't take himself too seriously. I mean, Eliot was obviously the towering 20th century genius in English poetry, but he wasn't much use if he wanted to be a poet yourself. There's hardly a line in Eliot which doesn't have the Eliot music to it. Another very bad influence, even worse, obviously, was Dylan Thomas, because there's only one person who's going to sound like Dylan Thomas, and that was Dylan Thomas. Whereas Auden always sounds like Auden, but he gives you the tools, I think, to develop your own voice with the confidence that you can do either this or that. You don't have to, you know, make a choice. Hardy, obviously, is a major presence for any modern writer in English. Although he has been an important poet to me, I don't think I've ever felt the excitement that I felt over Auden or Larkin with Hardy. There's something slightly archaic about his syntax. I think his worldview, I agree with it, you know, sort of deeply realistic pessimism about the individual life, about the life of mankind. Any way to the better there be exacts a full look at the worst. I think that's an absolutely, you know, brilliant philosophy. But I would like, I think, a little more humour in my poetry. So I'm a huge admirer of Hardy, but I wouldn't say he was my favourite poet.
Well, now, during much of this time, so talking about the 1980s and 1990s, you were actually earning a living from poetry. So you were presenting Poetry Please, and you were doing lots of other radio programs, and you were editing three anthologies for Faber, the Faber books of Drink, Murder, and Christmas. And you were writing a political satirical poem every week in the Weekend Guardian for 8 years between 1988 and 1996. Two collections of which are published, and they are hilarious and full of saeva indignatio. What was it like, that professional, to a deadline, to order even, writing life? Did you love it or hate it?
Well, I loved the weekly and monthly paychecks. I wouldn't have done both had they come up in a different order. I got the Guardian gig first, and I was very much in two minds about taking it on. And then within a month, I got the Poetry Please gig. And I think if the Poetry Please had come up first, I would have said no to the Guardian. I'm not sure whether that would have been the right decision. I didn't have to write a poem a week for the entire duration of my residency, if you like to call it that. But to begin with, it was every week on a topical subject. And I knew that I wasn't a genius, so there were going to be some poems which were pretty humdrum. On the other hand, there are some poems that I would never have written without that, which I'm very pleased that I did write. And I think it gave me a rare opportunity, almost unique, in fact, to have a weekly column, but I had my weekly column in verse. And I think it improved me as a writer. It certainly toughened me up as a freelance, because sometimes the deadlines were very tight indeed. I remember writing one poem. I was coming down from Edinburgh at the end of a run of a show. I stopped in a service station at about 2 o'clock in the morning, wrote my poem. And in those days, there was no email or internet or anything, so you could ring the paper up and dictate it. So I dictated my poem, then got back in the car, drove all the way back down to Wiltshire, and then I was playing cricket for Devizes' first 11 in the afternoon. So things could be quite tight. And when Mrs. Thatcher finally went, which is the poem I'd been looking forward to writing for a very long time, I actually believed her when she said she was going to fight on, and wrote my poem on the basis that she was going to fight on in the leadership election. And I'd sent my poem off, and I remember that the following morning the phone went, and this urgent voice said, "She's gone." I said, "Who's gone?" "Mrs. Thatcher, she's resigned, she's going." I said, "What?" So I then had to ring up the Guardian and say, hold the front page, or whichever page I was on. I then had 2 hours in which to knock off something else, which actually, under the circumstances, I was quite pleased with. But there were moments when it was a bit hairy.
Well, now, in the middle of all this, you wrote and then published your one and only biography, The Life of England's Greatest Cricketer, W.G. Grace. Now, you can't get much further from poetry, even topical political poetry, than biography. As being a biographer myself, I know. So now I want to know, how did that happen, and how did you find that particular change?
Well, I'd finished with the radio by that stage, and I'd more or less finished with the Guardian. So I did need something else to fill that gap. But it came about, like so many things in my life, by chance. Matthew Evans, the chairman of Faber & Faber, heard a very light-hearted programme I'd put together on the development of the laws of cricket, which, like the laws of most games, I think probably evolve as people try to get round the laws that exist. And W.G. was a genius, but he was also a bully and a pirate and not a very sporting sportsman. So he loomed fairly large in this programme. Anyway, word came down from on high that Matthew Evans was interested in a biography. And it really did feel like an offer I couldn't refuse. I mean, it was a huge opportunity. I think one of the things which made me a good choice was that I knew very, very little about either W.G. or about Victorian cricket. I had some experience as a researcher, having failed to complete a DPhil at Oxford. And I did have a half of a history degree, and that was pretty much all I had going for me. But it did mean that I went out with an open mind. I did find out some things that no one else had found out before, but much more importantly, I put together the things that everybody knew in a different way to show, A, what a deeply piratical man W.G. had been, and B, to show what extraordinary power he wielded in the world of cricket. I think it's probably fair to say that no other sportsman has ever dominated his sport to the extent that WG did. I mean, being twice as good as the next best person helped, and having a hide like a rhinoceros, and simply being ungainsayably bigger than anybody else. I mean, he was a huge man. Quite peremptory. I mean, he was like the young Henry VIII, just indomitable. You know, he just smashed through life and everybody just had to get out of the way. He was great fun to study and live with for 2 years. But the life of research, you know, it's a very quiet life. And then, as you know, I mean, writing a biography is very straightforward. You just have to turn your huge pile of notes into a smaller stack of typescript. And how you do that is the miracle of being a biographer.
Yes, I'm glad you call it a miracle. It could also be called other things. So I think what you're telling us is that when you'd finish that job of work, no more biographies.
I pulled a muscle in my brain. I mean, I'm a very lazy man, and that was much too like hard work. And I was sort of walking wounded after that. And the thought of doing it all over again. I mean, anyway, I at least knew my limitations, and I would never, ever do another biography.
Moving on from there, in 1999, so that's the next year after WG, you leap into playwriting. Your first play is performed in 1999. Then over the next decade or so, you write and produce another half dozen or so plays, of which the most successful are Grass, your play about John Clare in 2001, and your two cut-to-the-bone Shakespeares, Hamlet in 2004 and The One-Man Macbeth in 2011. So please tell me about that. How did playwriting start? Was it much more to your taste than biography, as I suspect? And how far back in your life does the interest in theatre go?
Well, I'd been doing dramatised documentaries in my BBC days. I did one on Clare, which was the basis of the stage play Grass. And I did one on Blake. And I mean, the cricket programme that Matthew Evans heard was the dramatised scenes in it. So I liked the idea of telling a story through dialogue. The first play, A Quiet Night In, I just had the idea of this couple who were sort of committed to each other, but she wants to have a baby, he's not so sure, which has always been my feeling about babies, although I'm excessively pleased with the three children I have fathered. And then into that mix comes this comic, failed historian who's missed the biggest deadline of his possible life in failing to get his history of the 20th century done in the 20th century, and he's going to commit suicide. So it's a black farce, really, and I wrote that with enormous gusto. It was a great joy, and I realised that I could do this and wanted to do more of it. And then when Grass came along, and that was brilliantly performed by David Keller, who trained at RADA and had been with the RSC, a marvellous actor. And I thought, having found an actor of that calibre, it would be positively rude not to write more stuff for him to do. So we then collaborated on the T. Shakespeare's. But along the way, I wrote children's plays and various other things. And I do. I absolutely adore the whole thing of performance. I mean, the trouble is, you know, it's very stressful. It's very unpredictable. Well, actually, it's not that unpredictable. The one thing you can predict is you're not going to make any money out of it, which is ultimately where I had to draw the line, I think, because, as you say, I was producing as well, which is tough. It's very tough indeed. But I don't regret that decade. I don't regard it as a lost or wasted decade at all. We had some wonderful times, and I'm pretty pleased with the plays that I wrote, and indeed with the two Shakespeare adaptations.
Now, you were writing other things, for example, librettos for two composers. But now comes a big change. Perhaps this one really is a violent change. About 5 years ago, you started writing novels for younger readers. So the first was Unplayable, a cricket novel about an 11-year-old boy, and I suppose four 11 to 15 or so-year-old boys. That was published by your own company, Top Edge Press, in 2009. Then the second, Keras, about a boy and a unicorn, or actually about a boy and a girl in a unicorn, came out from David Fickling Books in 2013, and a third, Medusa's Butterfly, in 2014. Now, this was a huge change in so many ways. So, several questions. First of all, what was it like publishing yourself? Now, this is the new way, I think, and we all need to know about it. So, could you tell us?
Well, the reason I did that was because I had written this cricketing story about the boy who saves England in the Ashes, and I wanted it to come out for the Ashes series of 2009. And I started writing it on the 6th of November 2008. So I did submit it to one or two publishers. They liked it and they were interested in me, but they didn't get it. If someone had said, yes, we're leaving it late, but we think it's absolutely what we want to do, it is possible to turn a book round in a very, very short period. But anyway, they didn't. So then I was thinking, well, I can either waste this opportunity or I can do it myself. And I did debate over that, and as a professional writer, one is always very wary of vanity publishing and all of that. But I was very fortunate. I went to Charles Boyle, who had typeset several of my Faber anthologies. He'd left Faber and was now operating as a freelance and was himself interested in, you know, this sort of self-publishing thing. So he did the book for me. It was actually printed by one of the printers that Faber used. And it was pretty painless. It wasn't print on demand, but it was pretty quick. I mean, I think from the day Charles sent it off to the printers, we had sort of pallets of the book coming down the lane, an enormous, dauntingly huge lorry, within about 2.5 weeks. But that, of course, is the easy bit. The difficult bit is getting it out there, and I think that's where you really do need a publisher, because that's their job, you know, getting it out there, the publicity and all the rest of it. Although I got some help from a cricketing foundation which exists to extend the range of the game into schools and for young people, so in a way we were a perfect match. Selling books wasn't their bag either. So we sold enough copies to cover the printing costs. And it got me to where I needed to be next, which was with David Fickling, who liked it very much.
Now, second, I wanted to ask you, unlike your biography, and perhaps also your poetry, because poetry is usually a matter of endless obsessive rewriting, you've said that Unplayable poured out of you almost effortlessly. And it reads that way. It pulls the reader along breathlessly in a perfect sort of storytelling arc. So what made you think of writing for young readers like that? Did you have any inkling before you started that you were such a good natural storyteller?
No, and it's quite annoying to feel that I've made this discovery a bit late in the day, because there's no point in being falsely modest. I can tell a good story. But I do wonder if I'd stumbled on that earlier, whether I would have wanted to write for children, not having had children. I mean, I have wanted to write for adults, but not badly enough to actually do it. My sort of adult stuff is in the poetry and in the plays. Those tackle adult themes, normally adult crashing and burning in the fields of love and generally sort of life skills. But to just tell a story, which doesn't have to sort of park itself up while someone psychoanalyzes themselves or, you know, has an identity crisis or whatever, was just such a liberating thing. And I'm not a planner, so although I knew the curve of the story and have known the curve of each of the other stories that I've written, I didn't know how we were going to get there. I just sort of stumbled into it and just carried on going. And there are places in all three of those books where I'm a bit stuck, and then inspiration strikes, and that's it, bang, and you've got the next thing to keep it going. And I really write a book to find out what happens next just as much as the reader does. And I would always say to anybody writing stories, if you're not thrilled and excited by it, then you shouldn't be writing it.
Well, now, Keras is a magic story, you know, because it's about children meeting a mythical creature in real life. Unplayable, of course, about cricket, but actually is pretty magical too, because Tom, the hero, doesn't at the beginning know anything about cricket at all, and it's this operation on his shoulder after an accident that miraculously, you know, turns him into this unplayable bowler. So are you really interested, fascinated by fairy tale, mystery and magic? Is that part of the appeal of writing for children for you?
No, I don't think it is. I think I'm interested in the exposure to intense experience. And you're right, in those books, that happens to be mythical or magical. But I think I use or want to use the mythical and the magical to intensify the experience of life rather than being particularly interested in them per se. In another book that I've started and very much hope to get commissioned very soon, there's no magic at all, but there is the extreme experience of losing a mother, and it's about a family at war with itself. So it's pretty extreme, but there's no mythical figures or magical figures. It's just extremes. And no, I mean, I've really no idea where the unicorn came from. I can honestly say I have never read a book about unicorns or given them a moment's thought. But once I'd got the idea, I went with it. And I'm very happy with the outcome.
All right, Simon, let's end where we began with poetry. So your last collection, Gift Horses, came out in 2006. And the poems here seem much darker to me than your early work. There are many deaths, including those of a couple of unfaithful husbands, and one I think of your father. There's a poem about a torturer. That's the one that won the second prize in the National Poetry Competition in 1986. There's one about a cut-off penis in a field. There's one about some boys who run away from a fire, leaving their girlfriends to burn. So do you have, would you say, two sides as a writer? A kind of eager boy in love with cricket and storytelling, and an ageing poet who's larkingly, as it were, obsessed with death?
Well, I think chronologically I should point out that all the poems in Gift Horses had been written, and indeed the book was published before I started on Unplayable. And because of my particular publishing history, I sort of signally failed to get my first book of poems published at the time when most people do, in their late 20s. So Gift Horses is, in a way, a very, very slim selected poems. I mean, I think it's a very, very much better book than any previous collection would have been. But it does contain poems over a spread of perhaps 20 years. I mean, when you list them like that, it does sound a very dark collection. And I think I would say it's probably, if you're looking for one theme, it's the sort of theme of, you know, the sort of dark side of masculinity. I think one of the things that writing for younger readers gives me is a sort of rest from that darker view. And I don't want to write sort of happy, smiley stuff for kids, because I think, you know, they deserve to be treated with honesty. But clearly, there's a whole swathe of experience. I mean, sexuality, for instance, which we don't go to at that particular age range. And I suppose it is a sort of release from that dark, pessimistic side of my personality and my writing personality.
Now, one of the themes that I think runs through your work is a love for the natural world. And that starts in your early pastoral poems, and it goes on to a concern for the destruction of the world, of the natural world, at the hands of mankind. In 2002, you wrote a long poem to go with the music of Michael Stimpson in an elegy for our poor, battered planet, which is called The Angry Garden. And I'd like to ask you to end with a reading from verse 4 of The Angry Garden, and it's called Man.
Fire throws shadows through the cave. More mouths, more meat, new hands contrive the first crude spears. The bison fall and leave their image on a wall. Man makes his mark and then moves on, from turf stockade to Babylon. Mouths and markets, trade and war. Empires stretch from shore to shore. Swords and plowshares take their turn. The cities, then the forests burn. Furnaces light up the sky, declaring that the dark must die. The furnace roars, more mouths, more meat. Turn up the heat, turn up the heat. More mouths, more land. And so the forked flames are fanned When the black sun finally falls, it burns man's image onto walls. Forests flame and rivers boil. A poisoned wind tears at the soil. Oceans sicken, skies ignite. The last flocks dip in broken flight.
That was Simon Ray in conversation with Carol Angia. You can find out more about Simon on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 35, which was recorded by Carol Angia and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 36, the all-ages writer Eleanor Updale wittily exposes one of the more absurd tics of modern broadcasting, and the novelist Jonathan Tulloch celebrates his childhood dialect with a dash of dramatic panache. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.